This is the Sports Illustrated Boxing Podcast.
It's boxing.
A look inside boxing with Sports Illustrated's Chris Mannix. Interviews, analysis, and everything going on in boxing. And now a man who I wish was called the Boston Bleeder.
All doctors to the ER.
It's sort of like getting punched in the face.
Chris Mannix.
All right, welcome back to another episode of the SI Boxing Podcast. Glad you could join me this week. And a lot to get to. Busy week in the world of boxing. You had Sergey Kovalev winning back his piece of the 175-pound title. You had rumors that are more than rumors about Anthony Joshua coming stateside to defend his pieces of the heavyweight crown against Jarrell Miller. Also, Gennady Golovkin. We are still waiting on Gennady Golovkin. Talk about that and more. I bring in Mike Coppinger, the great writer over at Ring Magazine, works for Fox Sports. We break down all the week's news with Mike. A little bit later on, Steven Espinoza, the president of Showtime Sports and Event Programming, he joins me in studio, and we run through an interesting first quarter for Showtime. This time last year, Showtime was rolling out a lot of big fights and a lot of big fighters. Now, it's Fox doing that. What's the latest with Showtime's programming with Manny Pacquiao? And of course, we get into the future of Floyd Mayweather with Steven Espinoza. Quick housekeeping note, if you like this podcast, very easy way you can support it. Head over to Apple Podcasts, also known as iTunes, post a comment, leave a rating. It's simple, it's easy, it's free. It's the best way to make sure that we keep doing this podcast week after week. That's it. All right, let's go. All right, joining me now on the podcast, you can read his stuff in the pages of Ring Magazine, ringtv.com. You can see him as Fox Sports Boxing Insider for the Inside PBC shows and some of the broadcast. He's Mike Coppinger joining me here in studio. What's up, Mike?
Hey, Chris. Thanks for having me on.
Glad you to be here. A lot going on these days in the world of boxing, as there seems to be every single week. But I want to begin with what we saw this past weekend. Sergey Kovalev, last August, knocked out by Eledir Alvarez. Looked like it might spell the end of Sergey Kovalev's career. He comes back and wins a pretty convincing decision against Alvarez, which sets him up for a number of significant fights in 2019. You were ringside for that fight. How did Kovalev look to you?
I thought he looked really good. He went back to basics, used his jab a lot, as we saw in the Bernard Hopkins fight. Boxed a great matchup. I was a little surprised that Alvarez didn't press the action more, because he did stun him a couple of times with those overhand rights that he was looking for, and he was the much bigger guy in there, but he just couldn't push him back. But I credit that with Kovalev's great jab, and he had a lot of great lateral movement as well.
You know, Andre Ward was talking during the broadcast and after the fact about how, you know, Kovalev was good, but he'll never be the same fighter he was before the two losses to Ward. That, you know, basically the message being that those losses took something out of Sergey Kovalev. Do you think that's true?
Absolutely. Once you quit in the ring, which I absolutely believe Kovalev did in that second Ward fight, now that mystique is gone. He's no longer boxing's boogeyman. So a guy like Alvarez comes in, knocks him out too. I think he's still a really good fighter. I don't see him as a pound-for-pound guy anymore, but he can still prove that. If he fights an Arthur Beterbiev or Gilberto Ramirez, he has the chances there at one of the best divisions in boxing.
You know, the thing about Kovalev too is that, I mean, look, you can say that he quit. Maybe he did. One thing, I said this on a previous podcast, he doesn't know how to react when he gets hurt. When he gets hurt, he kind of just wants to keep fighting. He doesn't have that sort of instinct to cover up, or the skill set to cover up or tie up or even take a knee and take the original knockdown. If he had taken a knockdown, I don't know if in the Ward fight it would have mattered, but certainly in the first Alvarez fight, by taking a knee, I think he would have been able to salvage it. And we didn't see him in that type of trouble in the rematch against Alvarez. So I wonder, moving forward, if he fights a big puncher, you know, like a Beterbiev, who's got some power at that weight class. Bivol, though he hasn't shown it, certainly has some power in that weight class. I still don't know, Mike, how he responds to a big shot, if he's gotten any better at it since the last fight.
I'm totally with you there, Chris. He hasn't shown an ability to really recover or bounce back when he's hurt. Like you mentioned, the reason I think he quit against Andre Ward is we saw in that round 7, way before the low blows that ended the fight, Ward landed that massive straight right hand, and then Kovalev later in the round turned his back and started walking away. That, to me, in any fight, is a sign of submission. So I like to see Kovalev face some adversity again. He showed a great ability here to rebound after being knocked out. But yes, like you said, we have to see it mid-fight.
Do you see any influence of Buddy McGirt, his new trainer, in this fight? And how much credit do you give him for the way Kovalev performed?
I give Buddy a ton of credit, Chris. I was actually just watching Roy Jones versus Antonio Tarver 1 a couple of nights ago. And
you got to get a life, Mike. You got to get a life.
I really do. Too much free time, I suppose. But Buddy did a great job with Tarver in that fight. He preached jab, 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 the same thing he did with Kovalev in this fight. And there's some similarities there, of course. Both 75-pounders. Both guys are rangy guys with nice, educated jabs. As long as Kovalev keeps listening to Buddy on that, I think he can really extend his career. Buddy did something similar for Arturo Gatti, and I don't think Gatti is nearly as talented as Kovalev.
Yeah, and Kovalev now finds himself with a lot of options in the division because he's still the biggest name in the light heavyweight division. You and I both know there are some really talented guys in that weight class, but not a lot of named fighters. So Kovalev's association with Main Events, which can effectively work with whatever promoter's out there and make some money, kind of the way DiBella has worked with other promoters over the last year. He's now in a great spot. I mean, is there a fight that you'd like to see him take next? And what do you think the future is for Kovalev?
Well, for one, I know that Top Rank holds a number of options on Kovalev, and they have a long-term pact right now Main Events. Maybe. So, yeah, we'll see.
So maybe not Dmitry Bivol then.
Yeah.
No, we won't see that.
Yeah, let's not count on Bivol for now. But Top Rank is definitely going to be putting his fights on ESPN and ESPN+. I think they're going to look at Gilberto Ramirez, who's fighting at 175 in his next fight. There's also Better Biev, who's going to fight Sullivan Barrera in the spring. He wins that fight. Kovalev's right there for him. Besides those two guys, I don't really... Oh, there's also, of course, Alexander Voza. Can't forget him. Mm-hmm. He's the lineal champion. He's returning in March. So there's three big names I look at, so to speak. Maybe not big household names, but three names that boxing fans know and should give Kovalev a really good fight and pretty much pick 'em fights, I think, with all three of those guys.
Yeah, they're good fights. Would Kovalev, though, want a Ramirez fight? I mean, that kind of positions him as a kingmaker, and I'm not sure Kovalev wants that at this stage of his career. I mean, he said he wants to unify the titles. That obviously does nothing for him there. I'd like to see a Gvozdzyk fight. Like, sign me up for that. Like, that's a pretty good matchup stylistically.
The question, though, there is, does Igas Klimas want to match two of his guys against each other?
That's a good point.
We've seen managers like Cameron Duncan, famously, who refused to put their two fighters in with one another. I'm not sure. I don't think Igas has really had the opportunity yet, as far as I can think.
So what's the... I mean, is Ramirez then the most likely at this point?
I think we're going to look at Ramirez or Better Biev. Ramirez, though, is open right now. He doesn't have any fights scheduled. Maybe they could have Kovalev return in June, July. Ramirez fight right there. But if you're Ramirez and Ramirez's team, do you really want him going right to Kovalev in his first fight at 75?
That goes right into arguably the best guy at 175, or at least one of the top guys at 75. That might be a lot to ask for. Let me ask you about the undercard in that fight. Richard Comey, he wins his piece of the 135-pound title. As long as that hand is healthy, it sets him up for an April fight against Vasily Lomachenko. Lomachenko, Mike, is a brilliant fighter, one of the greats in boxing today. But we've seen at 135 pounds, bigger fighters can cause him a couple of problems. We saw it in his last fight. We certainly saw it against Jorge Linares. You look at Comey, and he is a rangy lightweight for his weight. I think he has the potential to cause Lomachenko a lot of problems. How do you see that matchup that they're kind of building towards in April?
For one, I would be a little surprised if it happens in April. I think that hand is more badly damaged than they're letting on. But it's going to happen at some point, I'm sure. I agree with you. I think Lomachenko is really testing his limits now. 135 is simply not his weight class. He's really a featherweight. And at some point, someone's probably going to knock him off. And if it's going to be somebody, why not Richard Comey? Like you said, he's rangy. He's a big puncher. He's really strong and powerful. I think Lomachenko is really biting off more than he can chew here. And it's just a matter of time. But if you're Top Rank, don't you want Teofimo Lopez to be that guy?
You think Lopez is ready for him? First of all, I love me some Teofimo Lopez. Like, he was SI's prospect of the year. We've had him here in studio to do the podcast. You can check out that interview in our archives. He's charismatic. He's powerful. But he's pretty young. I mean, he's very early in his pro career to be stepping into the ring with, you know, arguably the top pound-for-pound fighter in boxing, isn't he?
I wouldn't put him in there just yet. But I don't think Teofimo's too far off from being able to challenge Lomachenko. Although Teofimo told me when I was at the fight on Saturday that this is absolutely his last year at 135 pounds. He said he's moving up to 140 next year, that he wants to fight with Lomachenko, and he hopes it can come maybe December. I don't think it's totally unreasonable. He's a guy that's well is educated beyond his years as far as a boxer. He seems to do a lot of things well, punches from angles, really strong. He would have a significant size advantage over Lomachenko. And if you're a top rank and you want stars to fight on ESPN, who better than Teofimo?
Yeah, you know, looking at Teofimo's career, what do you think people missed about him coming out of the Olympics? I mean, he wasn't a ballyhooed signing. He was a good fighter, but he didn't have this great run in Rio. He certainly wasn't, you know, touted in the same ways the other guys, the top rank signed, the Michael Conlins, the Shakur Stevensons. What do you think people missed about him? I mean, this guy is going to be, is clearly more ready for a title shot on a faster track than any of the guys that came out of Rio.
I think it's really hard to evaluate guys at the amateur level. So it's really not the best indicator of success at the pro level. They're just such different games. I think people did probably miss out on his speed. I didn't realize he was quite this fast with his hands and his feet. And he has a really good understanding of angles. He comes from everywhere. It's a bit Pacquiao reminiscent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's fun to watch, man. And he comes to knock guys out. Skill set, speed, charisma. I mean, he's got the potential to be a big star. And as you mentioned, moving up in weight. I mean, at some point, he's probably going to turn into a welterweight. We know what kind of fights are up there in the next 3 or 4 years. All right, let's turn to the heavyweight division for a second here. You reported this past week that Jarrell Miller, Anthony Joshua have an agreement in principle, some details still to be worked out, to have a fight sometime in June at Madison Square Garden. It'll be Anthony Joshua's first fight in the U.S., taking on an undefeated fighter in Jarrell Miller. I've been told that this fight is all but done at this point. We could see a press conference, press tour at some point in New York next week. And I'm interested in this fight. I really am. I don't know that Jarrell Miller is on Anthony Joshua's level, but I tell you, I'm far more interested in seeing Jarrell Miller, Anthony Joshua, than Dillian White versus Anthony Joshua. It's not a knock on Dillian White, who has done everything you want a guy to do after he loses a fight. Dillian White lost to Anthony Joshua, and he didn't, you know, take time off. He didn't fight, you know, lesser level opponents. He stepped in there against guys like Joseph Parker and Derek Chisora. The next time Dillian White gets a title shot, he deserves it. I just think for my personal interests, Miller just does more for me. He's a bit of an unknown commodity, but his size, his volume punching, there's just more interest in there to me. What do you think?
I've seen a lot of people panning this Joshua Big Baby fight. I disagree. I'm with you on this. I think it's a fascinating fight. Joshua is the best of the bunch at heavyweight, but none of those guys are really, to me, you know, I'm not going to count anybody out against Joshua, who is, as long as they're on a certain level. Big Baby's right there. He's really strong. He's about 315 pounds. He's going to lean on him all night. He's a volume puncher. He has fast hands. You have to pick Joshua, but it's not. I don't think this is some kind of walkover.
No, I don't think it's a walkover. My question about Jarrell Miller is, you know, as you look at his resume, there's nobody on it that you would say that guy is even like a B plus level opponent that has you prepared for Anthony Joshua. The guys he's fought on DAZN as of late, they've been vastly inferior opponents, you know, up until this point. The guys he fought on HBO, the Marius Vox of the world, they have been vastly inferior opponents. He hasn't had, I mean, who you look at his resume, Mike, who's the best fighter he's faced up until this point?
I guess you have to go with Walker and Gerald Washington, who are definitely sea level or below.
Right. Those are definitely sea level fighters. So do those guys prepare you to fight the number one guy in the division? That's what worries me, that he's not. That everything he's shown, the volume punching, shown a good chin, certainly charismatic, but is any of that carry up when you fight a guy with the power and skill of Anthony Joshua?
It's a fair question. I think Jarrell definitely would have been better served by fighting a couple of guys in the bottom of the top 10 or even the top 15. We haven't seen that, but when a chance like this comes and he's getting massive, massive money for this fight, you have to take it. It's perfect for Joshua's U.S. debut. And you're right, the Dillian White's done a lot more since then. He's beat Joseph Parker, beat Derek Chisora twice. He deserves the payday more, but, boxing's not a meritocracy.
I kind of like that Dillian White's just, you know, he was pissed for a while, and now he's turning right around and saying, what's next? And he's looking at Dominic Brazil, which I think is a solid fight that could clear up some of the mess in the WBC mandatory rankings. I don't know if Brazil's going to take that fight, but I would hope he does, because I think there's some money behind it if he takes the fight in the UK. That's an interesting fight to me. If he's not going to get Joshua, I like that he's stepping right back in the ring, maybe as soon as April, and taking on a top guy like Brazil.
Dillian White's a throwback for sure. He'll fight anybody. And you know, he doesn't have Eddie Hearn long-term. He's fighting with Eddie Hearn on a fight-by-fight basis. Not a lot of people knew that. He has a lot of flexibility there to fight whomever he wants.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I'd like to see him keep fighting those PBC guys, whether it's affiliated with the PBC or not, whether it's in the U.S. or the U.K. You know, there are some good fights out there for Dillian White to kind of force his way, either through a mandatory challenge or because he's become so popular that you'd have to give him a big-time fight. Let me ask you about the Fury and Wilder negotiations. You know, last week, the WBC postponed a purse bid. I don't know what they needed to have a purse bid in the first place. This fight seems like it's barreling towards actually happening. But where do we stand with all this? I mean, how likely is it that this deal gets done for a fight sometime in May or June?
That fight's all but done right now, I'm told. They're just trying to button up some, you know, smaller details between the two. But the purse split's agreed to, and it's definitely going to happen. They have to nail down a location and a date. It's looking likely like May 18th, but we still have to wait and see there. And the purse bid, I think, is going to push it a little closer, but really not necessary. We're not going to see a purse bid.
So when you look at that fight, you know, one of the things that Freddie Roach said to me recently was that he thought that Tyson Fury stood the better chance of being better in the rematch. And Deontay Wilder, when he was in New York after the fight, he said there's no way that Tyson Fury can be better or can be anything but damaged after taking the kind of punches he did and that knockdown that he did in the final round. When you look at these two guys after that first fight, which one of them do you think has the better chance of being a better fighter in the rematch?
I think Deontay Wilder has the better chance of being better. I scored the first fight from ringside 116-110 for Fury. I expect Fury to win the rematch, but I thought Fury boxed as well as he can pretty much, you know, aside from the knockdowns. Deontay Wilder was so close to knocking him out. He's one of the biggest punchers of all time. You know, he's going to be 1 inches away again from clipping him. So he has, you know, he even admitted that he was overshooting that right hand. He was a little anxious. That was really his first big fight. And Fury's been in a couple of big fights like that. Vladimir Klitschko, etc. I think Wilder can do better than before.
Yeah, I would go the other way because I waited, you know, to see what Fury looked like coming out of the holidays to see if after the Wilder fight that he just went out and partied and if he blew up in weight. Didn't seem like he did that. It seems like from the videos and the pictures that I've seen, he stayed in pretty good shape during his vacation. And this is a guy that was, you know, he was two fights into a comeback that you know, kept him out for 2.5 years. I think that as long as that knockdown didn't affect him, I think he can be an even more aggressive boxer. I think he can be even more skilled in the ring. Certainly conditioning-wise, he might be even better. And I saw some flaws in Deontay Wilder. I thought he got hit a little bit harder than he kind of let on in that fight. Fury's not a big puncher, but he's still a 6'7", 250-plus pound heavyweight. He hits you square in the nose. That's going to hurt a little bit. I think Fury can be a little bit better, Mike.
Fury definitely hurt Wilder a couple of times, most notably in the rounds 9 and 12, the rounds he was actually knocked down in. Showed a ton of balls in that fight. You're right. He can definitely hurt Wilder, and the conditioning can definitely be a lot better. I'm certainly going to pick him in the rematch, and I think it's a fascinating rematch for sure. Draw aside.
Yeah. All right. You've been covering the negotiations between Wilder and Anthony Joshua. Clearly, it's not going to happen for the first half of 2019. But assuming that Wilder comes through the Fury fight unscathed, and Anthony Joshua comes through a Jarrell Miller fight unscathed, what's your level of optimism? And what have you heard about the likelihood that we'll get Joshua versus Wilder at some point before the end of the year?
I know DAZN and John Skipper really want that fight for the end of the year. They're willing to pay top dollar for it, but boxing politics, as always, are going to be an issue. Deontay Wilder, of course, aligned with PBC, fighting on Fox / Showtime. Anthony Joshua over there with Eddie Hearn and DAZN. Politics are going to have to be bridged. How do you do that? Does DAZN maybe do pay-per-view and do a split pay-per-view with Showtime or Fox? I don't know. That's going to have to be figured out. But I think the other stuff, as far as the money is concerned, can be sorted out. But Wilder's going to hold firm now. He's not going to take the same kind of deal that was on the table last time that he wouldn't even take then. He's going to want parity. Is Eddie Hearn going to want to give that? Is Joshua going to want to give in to that?
Yeah. You know, as much as I hate how long these negotiations have dragged out, they haven't quite reached Mayweather-Pacquiao level, of course, but as much as I hate it, because of what happened in Wilder Fury 1, if he comes out and is really impressive and stops Fury and Joshua comes to New York City and stops Jarrell Miller, that's going to make the fight even bigger, isn't it? I mean, that's going to make it worth the wait if they can get a deal done in 2019.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, the fight, I know last year that they were saying that people in the industry were saying the fight wasn't as big as it possibly could be, and they wanted it to marinate a bit. I think that's part of the reason we didn't see it last year. You're right. If those two scenarios play out, it's going to be a much, much bigger fight. It's going to reach a fevered pitch where, you know, even casual fans are begging for the fight. I just wonder about those boxing politics with the networks.
That's the biggest heavyweight fight in well over a decade, maybe two decades at this point. I hope politics don't get in the way of a fight like that. All right, let me ask you about Gennady Golovkin, because it seems like I ask every guest every single week, and I have this conversation about Golovkin, because I'm astonished, Mike, that we're still sitting here in early February, and Gennady Golovkin still has not decided what he wants to do with his future. He has had multiple meetings with DAZN, multiple meetings with PBC. He's fielded offers from ESPN and Top Rank and everything they're doing there, and yet he sits back still and has not made a decision, at least not as the recording of this podcast. What do you know about why Gennady Golovkin continues to wait and not make a decision here?
I wish you would decide already as well, Chris. It's certainly exhausting me and taking up a lot of my time. I think one part of the problem is he has so many people in his ear. Gennady and his wife have handled the meetings, I'm told, between PBC and Eddie Hearn /DAZN and Top Rank and ESPN. It's pretty much been him and his wife. And I'm told he also has two Kazakh businessmen from Silicon Valley that are also advising him now. So when you have so many people in your ear, that can be a lot. He was also waiting for the birth of his child, which happened a few weeks ago, to make a decision. I was told that he completed all his meetings last week. He met with Eddie Hearn and John Skipper on Wednesday morning in Los Angeles. Then he met with PBC later in the day, met with officials from ESPN /Top Rank on Thursday. I'm told it's now down to PBC and DAZN. But I know that DAZN's offering a lot more money. I can't see him leaving all that money on the table because that Canelo Alvarez fight is so lucrative.
I mean, LeBron James made a decision faster than he did. Like, this is like dragging on beyond weeks and now into months. And I know it's irked some people within DAZN that their offers, which are substantial, have not really been jumped on. And I'm with you. I just, you know, as you say there, and you point out that the money that DAZN's offering is bigger. Beyond that, I mean, I'm a fan of Charlo, and if we saw Golovkin versus Charlo, I'd probably buy that on pay-per-view. It'd be a good fight. But the opportunity for Golovkin, not just in the next two fights, but maybe three and four, if he winds up winning against Canelo, they're monstrous. I mean, think about what a Canelo fight would be worth in part four if Golovkin wins sometime in May. Like, that's even more money that he'd make for the third fight with him. It just doesn't, there's nothing logically that makes any sense why Golovkin would choose somebody else other than the offer, or something else other than the offer from DAZN.
Well, for one, both sides are only talking about two fight deals right now, so that really wouldn't tie him up past 2019 as far as I know.
No, but if he beats Canelo, you know that's third fight city right there. Like, that's our fourth fight city. Like, they'd be on to the next on that one for even more money. Like, that would have to be the case.
I'd really rather not see it a fourth time, but I'm down to see it a third time.
But at some point, like, no, if the fight's close and Golovkin wins, like, maybe they have a fight in between or whatever, and if Canelo wants a different fight, but they'd meet for a fourth time. Like, that would open the door for a fourth fight, which would be big business.
Well, sure. I mean, I think there's great options on both sides. If you're looking past 2019, Jared Hurd is fighting.
Yeah.
He's going to fight the winner of Tony Harris and Jermell Charlo in the fall. And he said that that's going to be his last fight at 54. He's going up to 160. Errol Spence Jr. is fighting Mikey Garcia in a couple of weeks at 147 pounds. But he's told me that he'd be willing to go to 160 at some point for Golovkin. He's a big guy who fought at 152 in the Olympics. So there are some options that don't really appear on the surface over at PBC besides Jermell Charlo, who I'm also a big fan of.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, you know, Jared Hurd's going to be a middleweight sooner rather than later. By the way, when he does move to middleweight, one of the great crimes of recent memory is going to be that we didn't get a Hurd-Munguia fight, 154 pounds. I mean, not the first time that boxing screwed up and not made a big fight, but that fight would be awesome between two big 154-pounders with distinct styles out there. So, yeah, I can see Golovkin, you know, after the first couple of fights, if it ends with Canelo, moving over to the PBC side, but he'll have a lot of options no matter what happens after this two-fight deal. When you watch Golovkin, I mean, it's clear he's lost something off his fastball. It depends on who you talk to and how much people think that is, but how many years do you think he has left? If you're gauging the career of Gennady Golovkin, what do you put it at?
I think he has at least 2 years left. You're right. The people in the industry are pretty split over how much he has left. I think people are a little too hard on him, the ones that say he's past it or badly faded. He just fought Canelo Alvarez, who's one of the three best fighters in the world. I scored it a draw in September. Golovkin rallied over the second half of the fight. He's still an excellent fighter, still a draw. He is going to be 37 pretty soon. Mm-hmm. How much do you think he has left?
I think he's probably got 2 years, four fights. I'd say 2 years, four fights, get him into late, at the end of his age 38 year, and that's probably going to be a wrap. On some levels, he's been preserved because of the problems with Universum when he was in his 20s, and, he wasn't fighting wars when he was in his early 30s. It's not till, the last few fights, whether it's Danny Jacobs or Canelo, that he's been in some dogfights. So I think that preserves him a little bit, but I think four fights is a pretty good number. And look, he doesn't strike me, Mike, as somebody that's going to stick around beyond when he has to. I mean, everything I've heard about his finances is that he's very good with his money. And if that's the case, I don't think he's going to be one of those guys that stays around until he's punch drunk. He might go out on top. He might win a fight. Let's say he wins the next two fights. He might beat Canelo and be like, you know what? I'm done. Pull a Juan Manuel Marquez and be like, yeah, I'm good. I'm done fighting after a significant win.
Yeah, I just never say never with fighters, especially with Vladimir Klitschko maybe coming back now. I mean, who knows with these guys?
You still think he's coming back? Because there are a lot of people. I mean, look, I'm not doubting you. And the impression I got from Vlad was not that he wasn't that he wanted to be done, but he was not going to do a Dillian White fight. But I don't know a lot of people that are inside on this that really believe that Vladimir is coming back. What do you put the percentages at for Vladimir coming back?
I would say it's like 50-50. I mean, Alex Krasiuk from K2 came out, I think, last week or so and said that Klitschko could come back. He wouldn't be surprised. I know he was seriously considering that three-fight offer from DAZN. There was a lot of things that he liked in there. They were going to donate a substantial amount of money to his charity, UNESCO, and he would have the chance to avenge his losses to Joshua and Fury. But of course, Klitschko, he's pretty, he's financially settled. He's made a ton of money. Can't imagine he needs the money. Maybe he just misses boxing, but I have no idea if he's coming back or not. I just know that it's something that was seriously discussed.
Yeah, if he was going to come back, a tune-up fight, Fury, and Joshua would be pretty good. Pretty solid. I don't know how many of those fights he wins, but I'd want to see him in all of them. Let me finish then with Manny Pacquiao and kind of the Pacquiao sweepstakes that's out there. We know the Pacquiao is going to wait as long as he can until he gets a firm answer from Floyd Mayweather, but there are guys that want Pacquiao. I mean, Keith Thurman, after his win over Jose Cito Lopez, he wants a piece of Manny Pacquiao. You know that the winner of the Errol Spence-Mikey Garcia fight is going to say, yeah, I'll turn around and fight, June, July, whenever it is that Pacquiao is ready to fight and take him on because they know the money that comes with it. How do you see the Pacquiao sweepstakes kind of shaking out in the first half of this year?
Like you said, Chris, it all centers around Floyd Mayweather. Whoever knows with him, he's already ended four or five retirements. I have no real clue if he's coming back or not again. I don't think anybody really knows except for Floyd. Outside of Floyd, I fully expect Pacquiao to fight the winner of Errol Spence and Mikey Garcia, possibly in July, like you said. That's a big-time fight, no matter who it is. It's another big payday for Pacquiao. And yeah, if not the winner of that fight, then Thurman. But I would look to the winner of that fight.
You think he'll wait until early March to make a decision? I mean, it's not that far away, I guess. But you think he'll wait with Keith Thurman kind of out there clamoring for it?
Yeah, I think he's going to wait. I've been hearing, as far back as September that he was looking at the winner of Spence and Garcia to fight. He really likes the Spence fight, especially because he knows he'd be a big underdog.
Really? Freddie Roach really likes the Garcia fight for obvious reasons. I think he sees physically Pacquiao, the less risk of Pacquiao getting manhandled in a fight like that. I don't know, but there's danger all around. I mean, it's not like there's a huge size advantage between Pacquiao and Mikey Garcia, but there's obviously a danger physically with Errol Spence. If not Pacquiao, then what's next for Keith Thurman? I mean, is he going to go? I mean, he keeps talking like it's a comeback year, which is driven me a little bit crazy, and I've said that on this podcast. But is there a natural fight for him out there that isn't one that we kind of look at and be like, I don't want to see that?
I fully expect Thurman to fight Sean Porter in a rematch later this year, as long as Porter beats Ugas on March 9th. That fight's been brewing for a couple of years now. Of course, Thurman, like you said, has been out for a long time. It's a fight I really want to see again.
Yeah, I mean, I'd like to see that too. It was a good stylistic matchup a couple of years ago, and I think it'd be a pretty good fight right now. Mike, always appreciate your time, man. Keep up the great work with Fox, Ring Magazine. You can follow Mike on Twitter, at Mike Coppinger. Mike, thanks for joining me, man.
Thanks a lot, Chris. Appreciate it.
All right, joining me now on the podcast, a bona fide friend of the podcast. Stephen Espinosa is the president of Showtime Sports and Event Programming. He covers, in charge of all things boxing on the Showtime networks, on pay-per-view, which, as we know, is dead. Stephen, Stephen, welcome to the show.
This is the first time you've come to me. I'm like moving up, either that or you got kicked out of your studio.
It might be a little bit of both.
Okay.
Be a little bit of both. But it's nice that you, since you preside over dead programming, you know, the end of...
Our business model is dead,
even with pay-per-views coming around the corner. But a lot I want to get into with you, and I was thinking about this as I was preparing this interview. Mm-hmm. Every time you and I talk, there's always like something out there that you wonder how Showtime's going to react to. And it usually involves an Al Haymon venture, who you've been... You know, had a relationship with Al Haymon for many years now. It's been highly successful for Showtime. But whether it was the Time Buy series or Al's other ventures, I've often wondered how it connects to Showtime. And here we are again with a similar type of situation. And I go back to this time last year, and you guys had a major rollout for the start of the 2018 slate. I think it was something like 12 world champions, 10 fights, some big events, Wilder Ortiz was in that mix. I know you have told me in the past you're fond of getting off to a fast start in the start of the year pretty early. This year, a different situation. You had a major pay-per-view, but you don't have a lot scheduled for the first quarter anyway of 2018. Right. Tell me about the difference, really, between this year and last year and what it means for Showtime.
You know, it's a valid question when you say we come in and we talk about sort of how is Showtime going to react. It's a valid question because I think without Haymon, you know, making sure that he wanted to treat networks even-handedly, it's each one of these developments, whether it's the Time Buys or Fox or whatever, could in fact be highly problematic for Showtime. But what he's proven and, you know, what we've worked out is that he is committed to a mutually beneficial situation, that this isn't going to be, hey, I found, you know, a prettier date. I'm going to go over here and Fox is the new shiny object, so that's where I'm going to put all the best fights. I think and more importantly, if you look at his track record, he has, the Time Buys were one thing, but, you know, in terms of his primary relationship, you know, whether it's Fox and in us, he's clearly tried to make it so that, you know, we're both continuing to be satisfied. The one thing that we weren't able to do, and it's just sort of a function of the market, is the rollout, is an upfront. And I think that's a lot of that is because, you know, we're back and forth with some of these fighters. So, you know, we've got some plans with Leo Santa Cruz, with Keith Thurman, with, you know, potentially the winner of Garcia Spence, and we could certainly sort of roll them out. It's a little bit weird because they do have interim fights, and more weird because they're interim fights that are not with us. So as a courtesy, you know, I certainly don't want to step on anyone and say, Leo's fight is a foregone conclusion. We're going to start talking about the next one. So I think we are starting to sort of populate and starting with this week, actually, we'll be going five straight weeks in a row with, you know, a couple of show boxes with our bookending a championship show. One thing that may or may not be announced, we can sort of break the news here, although I think it's been speculated, we are picking up DeGale Eubank as well as the co-feature Joe Joyce and Staverne. So if we look at that February you know, we just had a show box February 1st. We'll go February 9th with Tank Davis. Then we've got another show box on the 15th, and February 23rd is Eubank Davis, and then we're at March 2nd with Castaño Lara. So, you know, the activity is there, and I think we're getting to the point, as soon as we get through some of these Fox, we can sort of look further into the future and be able to announce it.
You had expressed some, I don't know if frustration is the right word, but you seem to like guys being Showtime fighters, mm-hmm. where you know if you want to see, let's use Leo Santa Cruz as an example, mm-hmm. you go to Showtime. That seems to be off the table, having that dynamic. Is that fair to say that you're not going to get strictly Showtime guys?
Probably not. I don't think it's completely out of the question. It's a little bit matchup specific. But look, I think there is value for consistency. I think for all of us who spend a lot of time writing and thinking and talking about boxing, it may be relatively easy to sort of say, okay, well, Leo's next fight is on Fox, you know, it's a little hard for us to keep track of even those who follow us regularly. I do think there's a value in not bouncing around. Now, whether that's outweighed by the value of broadening the audience remains to be made. I could make the case that even if there's sort of some confusion by bouncing around networks, you are refreshing the fan base, and that's a good thing.
What have you thought of the ratings early on for the Fox shows?
I'd be lying if I wasn't sort of proud of the ratings that we'd done on CBS, and you know, proud that they're larger than any of the audiences that we've seen so far. But I think they're a pleasant surprise. You know, they're certainly significant improvement from the time buys, including the time buys on Fox, and they show good momentum. So I think PBC views it as a win. I think the fans have gotten good fights. Even the matchups that were sort of A-, B-plus have turned out to be probably better than they look like on paper. So I think they're off to a really good start.
I was going to ask you about this later, but since you brought up CBS, mm-hmm. it's been, what, almost 2 years since there's been a CBS fight, the Keith Thurman-Danny Garcia mm-hmm. fight
right.
being the last one. That did a great number.
Mm-hmm.
Any explanation for why we haven't seen fights on CBS?
It's a lot of sort of circumstance and sort of strategic choices, and I'll explain both those. A is, you know, we have reserved CBS for really top-tier stuff, our biggest and best stuff. And for a fight of that caliber to line up at a time of the year when CBS has availability is one thing. The other thing is, I think it's great for the sport if we put a great fight on CBS, you know, and you peak at 5 million for Thurman Garcia, and I think that's a great thing for the fan base. But by the same token, it doesn't build Showtime, you know. So I think it's always been a bit of a sort of an occasional special attraction, so to speak, because the reality is the last thing we want to do is start putting a ton of good fights on CBS, and then people who have been paying and continue to pay for Showtime are just saying, well, wait a minute, what am I getting for what I'm paying? So I think we want to balance those two things and realize that really our core mission is to put the best fights we can on Showtime.
Al Haymon doesn't return my phone calls or
don't take your personal
any media's phone calls for that matter. But has he articulated to you exactly? I mean, look, the first few months you're seeing a lot of guys on Fox and on Fox pay-per-view. Has he articulated to you when those guys would be available to you and what kind of fights that he'd like to make available to you in the second quarter?
Yes. Look, if, you know, I think for the foreseeable future, Pacquiao's a guy who's going to stay with us. You know, certainly the next fight. So whether that's a Mayweather rematch, whether it's the winner of Garcia Spence, or whether it's Keith Thurman or somebody else, I think that's one that, even if it's, you know, at least my understanding, we don't have this in written in stone, but even if it's Pacquiao versus the winner of Garcia Spence, that would be with us. Mm-hmm. So I think it's highly matchup dependent. I know Fox has interest in pay-per-views. We've got one or two on the horizon. I'm not sure how many pay-per-views there are left in the market. I don't know. Other than, you know, Wilder rematch, another Pacquiao fight. I'm not sure there's another three or four for us and Fox to do beyond that.
On a scale of, let's say, 1 to 10, 1 being devastated, 10 being ecstatic on the Pacquiao pay-per-view mm-hmm. number, where would you fall?
I would say I'm a 6.5. And I think that is basically mainly because I'm never really all that satisfied. If you ask
eternal me, pessimist.
Yeah, exactly. I've got to maintain the eternal curmudgeon that I am. So
you're not Bob too much. Over the years.
No, I'm okay. Well, if I get to that point, please tell me. If I start saying, you know, 4.6 million buys is still like an 8.5, then you know I have a real problem. But you know, look, our target was, 400,000. I thought we had a potential to break out above that with a little bit of luck, but we also knew that we're battling Pacquiao being a little bit out of the spotlight for a while, and people questioning whether Broner could be competitive at that level. Those were all marketing challenges. So all in all, the fact that we expanded Pacquiao's audience, you know, relative to his recent fights other than the Mayweather fight, I think is a very positive thing, particularly when, you know, I think from a piracy standpoint, we're just dealing with the tip of the iceberg. And I think it's exponentially worse today than it was even 3 or 4 years ago.
Because of things like Periscope and Facebook Live
and
things like that.
You know, and new platforms coming up literally daily, mm-hmm. From Twitch to Loops to, you know, you name it. I'm sure there are some that I'm not even aware of yet. Mm-hmm.
What do you think of, and I had this conversation a couple of weeks ago with my guest on there about, you guys have been, you were well ahead of HBO in terms of streaming stuff. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the Fury fight versus Wilder, I bought it off the Showtime platform. Mm-hmm. Is that something you can see kind of expanding? I don't know if you are going to ever get away from the traditional cable mm-hmm. operator, you know, partnership, but using your website, using your app, I mean, you seem to be making advances monthly on that. What's the future in that with that?
Well, I think part of it is making this available to everybody. And as we see an increasing number of cord cutters, you're making sure that they have access to it as well as initially. The second, you know, it'd be disingenuous to not admit that the financials are different. You know, when we are splitting it, you know, roughly 50-50 with cable and satellite companies versus, you know, retaining all of it when it's on our own. So there's an advantage, you know, toward building that out. But I'm not of the mind that one will be eliminated completely at any point, certainly not in the foreseeable future. I think you have to be on both. I think it's a major advantage to having both. And I think, you know, part of that speaks to, you know, some of the challenges of getting a foothold in a crowded media space for, you know, for someone like DAZN coming in and trying to change consumer habits.
Mm-hmm. Did you see, I mean, have you seen any kind of uptick over the last year in people buying off your app and off that your site and going in that direction versus the traditional press buy on the cable box?
Yes, it's every the last two pay-per-views. You know, I'm not sure it's fair to include Mayweather McGregor in it, but the trend is on each one. It's a incremental growth, so it's slowly, but it's growing. Still a minority of the purchases by a long shot, but each fight, it's a greater percentage that is going digital. I think that's going to be, that trend will continue for the foreseeable future.
You did an interesting interview with Keith Idek before, I think it was before the Fury Wilder fight, mm-hmm. where you talked about reducing the cost of the pay-per-view and the possibility of expanding the audience. I mean, it's, you know, boxing's kind of bonkers in that way that their biggest events are always viewed by the fewest people. Mm-hmm. Theoretically, you reduce a price from 75 to 50, you might get more. I understand the argument against, as you articulated there, the, you know, fighters, it's kind of a bird in the hand with what fighters have.
Right.
They know this system's going to make them X dollars, but mm-hmm. do you think they will get to that point where a fighter will roll the dice like that and say, all right, let's drop it to 50 and see what we can do and risk, you know, potentially millions of dollars out there?
It's a tough thing to sort of see happening, because if you do reduce the price and you don't expand the audience, then you've just given money away. And the real question is, are there people who are not buying it at 65 or 75 who would buy it at 45 or 55? Or put it differently, you know, is there, if HD price is 75, you know, would someone buy it at 80 or 85? You know, not that we're looking to raise prices, but what has never really been determined is what amount of elasticity there is in that price, mm-hmm. you know, and I don't think anybody wants to experiment. I'm not sure, but my own personal reaction, I know that if you, one thing that we took away, I think, from the Tiger Woods, you know, Phil Mickelson thing is, if you're talking about a $20 or $30 price point, I think you significantly increase the audience. You saw that with not just Phil and Tiger, but also the Logan Paul, you know, and KSI. Mm-hmm. You know, that for $10, it's sort of like $10, $20, you know, why not? Whether, I think there is a real question, difference between $70 and $50, is that a big enough difference to really expand the audience?
Mm-hmm. The fight we just saw with Pacquiao, a pay-per-view, a fight coming up with Spence and Garcia, a pay-per-view. Thurman wants to fight Pacquiao on a potential pay-per-view. Mm-hmm. Are we getting close to the point where these top-tier welterweights are only going to want to fight on pay-per-view? In other words, can you afford to put these top-tier welterweight fights that are very makeable in your universe mm-hmm. on the regular Showtime platform?
I think so. There was definitely a decision or at least a conversation about making Spence versus Garcia potentially as a CBS event, as a Showtime event. What would it take, you know, even if it's an outsize, you know, larger than, you know, just about anything recently price? I mean, you don't have to go back that far to see something like, you know, Lennox Lewis and Vitaly Klitschko, I think was a $6 or $7 million license fee, you know, and it drew a huge audience and entertaining fight. It was worth it. So, you know, would for the opportunity to put a fight like, you know, Garcia Spence on, would we look at a number like that? Sure. Now, it depends on what you're projecting on the pay-per-view. If you're projecting, you know, 300,000 buys, you know, then you're talking about, you know, at least 10 million net to the promotion. That's probably not something that, you know, that is a pay network. We wouldn't go to that level. But that's why I think that sort of that 300,000 mark has sort of been the traditional dividing line. It's sort of if you are under 300, and certainly if you're in the 200s or less, you should have stayed off pay-per-view. Mm-hmm. Because those, now you're looking at an audience that may be bigger and money that's roughly the same. Mm-hmm. But if you're generating 10 million, that's going to be significantly more than, you know, than we're paying, than Fox is paying, ESPN is paying.
It's, you know, obviously you don't root for failure for anybody, but mm-hmm. you would almost, as an executive, you know, root for that 250 number and mm-hmm. say, well, if it gets that low, these fighters will want, you know, the money demands won't be as high, and we'll mm-hmm. get that fight on our platform.
Right. I mean, look, I've said it before, and I truly mean it. It takes a certain amount of sort of courage to go out there and not have the kinds of guarantees that you get off of pay-per-view. It's a risk. People always think, oh, you know, lots of money. No, not necessarily. There have been plenty of events that underperformed, and fighters didn't get what they expected. And guess what? You know, it doesn't make the fight any easier. They don't train any less. So there's also a downside. You know, when you go out, whether you're Crawford, Postal, or others, depending how the deal is structured, you know, there's definitely a risk for the fighters.
Are there things that you're looking at this year when it comes to a new player like DAZN entering the mix that's not going to go on pay-per-view with these significant events? How closely do you monitor the success and failure of that model in 2019?
not on an event-to-event, month-to-month level, but we certainly monitor it from sort of the consumer standpoint. You know, as the consumer looking at all the choices, you know, the type of content, what the price points are, how it's marketed, what the messaging is, I think you it would be silly for us not to monitor that very closely and realize how people are talking about their content, how they're talking about our content, and whether that's accurate, you know, and an accurate presentation of what we have to offer. So, you look, when we come in and a fighter says they want to go on pay-per-view and they're willing to take the risk, look, I can say, look, here's what, you know, I would pay on the network, and, you know, it's guaranteed. And but there are times when the fighter just says, look, I know I'm not guaranteed it, but I want to, you know, push the envelope, go and maybe generate something that can be, you know, significant, almost life-changing on one event. So it's as I see the fan standpoint as well, but it's hard to say no to a fighter when they say we want to maximize what we can make.
Adrian Broner took a loss against Pacquiao, but if, you know, the solid pay-per-view number, Pacquiao had a lot to do with that, but Broner has consistently been a very good ratings draw for you. What's your approach with Broner? Do you have a have you talked to Al about a plan to kind of bring him back at some point? Because he seems pretty eager to get right back into it.
You know, he definitely is, and I think, you know, putting aside his performance in the fight, you know, he looked good. He was in as good a shape as he's been, you know, in the last couple of years. And that itself was, I think, a surprise to a lot of people. Matching Broner is, it's sort of difficult because he is a tweener. Like, he's not, he certainly doesn't have the physicality to match up with a Spence or even, you know, I thought he held his own against Porter, but sort of physically, they're just two different frames. Like, it's just not a good matchup for Adrian. And I think one of the things that probably his antics sort of take away from is the fact that he has incredible amount of heart. Like, he is a guy who's going to fight all 12 rounds. You know, I understand that there's a lot of other things that turn people off, but you can't really fault his effort in the fight. You know, that's just, you've never, whether it's against the Maidana fight, whether it's against Porter, whatever it is, he gives you good action. You know, the question is, where are the good matchups that, you know, stylistically and weight-wise, you know, make sense? And, you know, the last thing we want, anybody wants, is to see Adrian, you know, fighting as an undersized guy, you know, facing, you know, a one in a million shot at winning, or beating up on a guy who, you know, significantly smaller than him.
What's the, well, I mean, I thought Freddie Roach made a pretty good point during the build-up where he said Broner, you know, if he had the discipline to get a 135 or 140, he could still be a force down there. And 140, I don't think he's, you know, significantly bigger than anybody else. You ran into him over the Super Bowl week. I don't know if you talked to him there about what he wants next, but how realistic is it that he can get to 140 pounds? You could start to match him at that weight.
I think it's kind of tough because if you look, he was a monster at 135. You look at his fights as 135 and you can sort of see why people were so excited about him early on. But, I felt like his frame has changed, you know, and as guys mature, you know, it's not uncommon. I don't think he's, you know, It takes a Herculean effort for him to make 140, and I think he'd have to cut a significant amount of muscle, you know, at that point. Whether he could do it or not, it would be a significant complete overhaul to how he trains now. And, you know, is it doable? You know, sure, anything's possible. But I don't really see a whole lot of guys, you know, at 140. Who would he do that for? Would he do it for, you know, meet Lomachenko there? You know, I don't know, maybe. I'm not sure that the upside is that much to sort of go through that for, you know, and look at what the reward would be for going through that.
Have you talked timetable at all for bringing him back?
We did. He asked me what the plan was when I, you know, saw him at Super Bowl, and he maintains he still wants to fight at least three times this year. Mm-hmm. So, I know Al is actively looking for another fight for him, and wouldn't surprise me if they announce something probably within the next 3 or 4 weeks.
To go back just for a second to the marquee fights on Showtime, as you look into the next 6 months, if you could make one fight for Showtime, a major non-pay-per-view on the channel fight, is there something that jumps to mind right away?
I would say if it's a non-pay-per-view, I would probably say Heard Charlo, Heard Harrison, you know, however that, you know, a unification fight there. And I think one that's very realistic is probably Leo and Gary Russell. And I think
Gary's a fascinating story, man. Just, I'd love to know what he does for 11 months out of the year.
No. It's a great question, you know, and I know fans are frustrated because he is so talented. Mm-hmm. But he's okay with the pace that he's on, you know. And look, it's a boxing crazy family. And, you know, they all train together, they work out together. And, you know, if he's okay with fighting once a year, I mean, who are the rest of us to sort of tell him otherwise?
Hey, I wouldn't want to go to camp and get my brains beat in. If I collect a million dollar check, it does not sound like fun.
Yep.
Couple things I want to finish with. Do you stay connected to the talks about Joshua and Wilder? I mean, how plugged into all that are you, and what's your sense on it right now? It's pretty clear that it's not going to happen next, but as far as 2019.
Yeah, I think this latest round of discussion or attempts at discussions were sort of, I think it was for perception only. It was all about optics because, you know, I think all of us said very early on, I think Wilder said early on, I said Fury said early on, and I think that the boxing public, you know, made it clear very, very early on that everyone wanted the rematch. And there was a contractual requirement. So, you know, the fact that the Matchroom side was, you know, more aggressive than ever after Wilder Fury, and the fact it remains that there really wasn't an opening for them to even get in and discuss that, you know, is more than a coincidence. It seems... it would seem, again, disingenuous to say that, you know, the fact that they were super aggressive about getting it made at the very point at which it was impossible to make, you know, you'd say, is that a coincidence? It probably doesn't seem that way. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I thought all of this, and I think that's a large part of the reason why Eddie's not getting, you know, he knows that there, all these discussions right now would be fruitless. There's one thing both fighters want, that the public wants, that the contract dictates. They're just talking about Wilder Joshua for April in Wembley was, you know, that was never, you know, get sued for breach, mm-hmm. among other things, by Fury. So that's not, you know, that was made clear to the Matchroom side and continues making calls and sending emails. I think so publicly he can say, I've sent emails and made calls. You know, we told you a long time, there's nothing to talk about until we get through this rematch. But if you want to continue to send emails, they're just going to go into the spam folder. Mm.
You have plenty of experience making high-profile fights when it involves two networks. Not experience, I'm sure you're eager to remember. That's not exactly the most fun times for anyone involved. But do you see, I mean, given what DAZN is as a platform and Joshua kind of being tied there for now, mm-hmm. and Wilder's been very loyal to Showtime over the years, is it possible for you to work together on a fight like that, or does it have to be one or the other?
It sort of feels on this one that it has to be one or the other, because it's one thing when we're in the same business, and there's a way to make the delivery work when it's us and HBO. It's a completely different business models with DAZN now. But I think there's a pretty clear solution. I think Eddie's been fairly clear that if there's a more lucrative opportunity off DAZN, that Matchroom fighters are not, you know, are not irrevocably bound to DAZN. And that's why I think that's what's the rationale behind the $50 million offer is, you know, if DAZN wasn't going to match that, which they've made no signs of, you know, take any steps to do that, then it's in the best interest of the fighter and the promoter to take the most lucrative deal. Now, I understand wanting to fight in the UK and rewarding your fans or home field advantage, whatever you want. But you know, the question is, are you willing to make 40% less to fight in front of your fans? You know, are you willing to put in dollar figures, you know, leave $20, $25 million on the table? You know, that's a lot to leave on the table, you know, to fight at home, especially when you've expressed a desire to come to the U.S. and fight. So none of the discussions and the responses, when they really don't make sense, when things, you know, aren't just piecing together, then there's usually an element here that no one is aware of or no one is acknowledging. And whether that's DAZN or different objectives, there's something else going on. Otherwise, this isn't that difficult a fix. I don't think it's as difficult a fix as Mayweather-Pacquiao was. And but I think until people are honest about what the objectives are and what all the various factors are, then I don't think we're going to get very far, as long as, you know, people have hidden agendas and maybe, you know, different motives.
You've been open in the past to doing kind of big fight one-offs. Mm-hmm. If that's what it came to, you want to put big fights on your platform. But the way things are kind of shaped nowadays, where it's so fractured and each promoter or advisor seems to have a foothold in specific divisions, mm-hmm. right? Is there any more value to you in kind of saying, I'm just going to invest in divisions? Like, for example, you've got featherweight, you know, a pretty strong stable mm-hmm. of fighters there. Obviously, welterweight, you have, beside Terrence Crawford, you have control over basically most of that division. Mm-hmm. Is there any thought to that? Like, you know, maybe we'll just be a featherweight, welterweight, whatever other weight that you're looking at. While on the other side of the street, you have, you know, ESPN's got light heavyweights, pretty well cornered middleweights mm-hmm. over at DAZN. Is that into your mind at all?
You know, it surprised me. That sort of was the strategy that we decided on, you know, 5 years ago or 6 years ago when I started. And it's not that we're smarter than anybody. That was the strategy going back to the 70s and 80s with ABC, CBS, and NBC, is whether there was an actual conversation or not, it just ended up they were in different weight classes. And it minimized, you know, any conflicts there. So it's sort of, to me, it's the most logical and rational way to do it, and it's the most fiscally responsible, because the last thing you want to do is develop one guy and be left with no opponents. I'm surprised that it's taking this long for others to get on board. And it looks like sort of that's the way things are going. Like you said, light heavyweight, 160, you know, there are divisions that other networks are sort of carving out a niche in. And I think that's probably the most satisfying way for boxing fans and for fighters alike.
Mm-hmm. Lastly, the obligatory, what do you know about Floyd Mayweather question? I mean, and you can tie it into Pacquiao and what the plan is. As you said earlier, you know, you've gotten the sense Pacquiao is going to be part of your platform kind of moving mm-hmm. forward. What's the plan with Pacquiao, and do you wait for Mayweather up to a certain date? Do you communicate with his people? What's the latest information you have there?
I think it's largely a decision that's in the Pacquiao camp, in terms of how long does he want to wait. Floyd has been coy. Sometimes he's interested, sometimes there's not. It's not really clear exactly, you know, whether he wants the fight immediately, whether he wants it late this year, next year, or whether maybe he sort of flirted with it and moved on. But at a certain point, I think Manny's got to make the decision. He does want to remain active. He does have congressional duties which dictate when he's available for camp and fights. So how long does he want to wait? Does he wait 6 weeks? Does he wait 3 months to see where Floyd is? Or does he say, look, Thurman's available, I'm available. You know, if I don't have anything from Floyd by the end of February, then I'm going to take something else. It's really up to Pacquiao at this point.
Have your feelings on Floyd coming back ebbed and flowed at all in the last, like, 6 to 8 weeks? I mean, has there been times you've been like, I think he's coming back? Other times where, no, maybe not.
I sensed, you know, around the time of the Pacquiao-Broner fight, I sensed a lot of that the idea was had cooled, that he'd cooled on the idea, that Floyd was sort of seemed less enthusiastic about it. And you saw it in the pay-per-view. He was, you know, coy, noncommittal, you know.
You didn't like that Jim Gray blink twice if you're going to fight question.
I don't think Floyd liked it.
I don't think Floyd liked it at all. Jim had to ask. That was a good, you know,
you have to.
Give me some kind of nod, Floyd.
And it's sort of like, you know, having done that video from Tokyo with Pacquiao, look, people are going to continue to ask that. But Floyd's never, I mean, if there's one thing that Floyd has demonstrated, it's that he doesn't answer to anybody else. And other people's deadlines, timetables, you know, decision points, you have no meaning to him. When he's ready to make a decision, ready to do something, he'll do it. And no amount of pressure from the outside is going to affect his timetable.
The one guy that can influence him, or has anyway, is Al Haymon. Mm-hmm. And I remember before the McGregor fight, you know, Floyd had said that Al told him, this is it. Take it, take the fight, make your money, and walk away. When you talk to Al about it, do you get the sense that Al wants him to fight or has an opinion on it one way or the other?
You know, Al is not just because of his brother, but because of other experience with the fighters he's worked with. He is attuned to safety to a large extent. And that's not something that we really have to worry about with Floyd. Look, no one knows exactly how, you know, some of these, you know, these chronic brain injuries happen. But you look at Floyd, and as good as he is defensively, he doesn't seem to be top of the list for risk of that. So I think the real question is, because there's not really, doesn't seem to be an immediate health issue, then the question is, you know, does it make business sense? And that's I think, truly just a function of the market, you know. And my suspicion is part of the reason why Floyd did that video is to gauge it. And if there would have been 90% of the market said we don't want it, then you never would have heard from it again. I think there was enough interest there that it makes sense. So I think it is certainly possible, but Floyd's, you know, keeping us all hanging the way he likes to. I mean, he's a master at it.
Steven, always appreciate it. I look forward to doing this again this time next year when we're discussing Al's new deal with Russia Today and you know, how it affects Showtime's bottom line, because you know that's coming.
Right. Absolutely. I'll see you soon.
All right, that's it for this week's episode. As always, you can download archived episodes on iTunes, TuneIn, Stitcher, really anywhere you can download podcasts. While you're there, post a comment, leave a rating. You know I appreciate it. And I'll see you next week.